Welcome back to Wildcats Podcast, the podcast run by Wildcats Conservation Alliance, exploring the conservation of the majestic yet increasingly vulnerable big cats who still roam Asia's remaining wild spaces. This is a bonus episode recorded for World Wildlife Day 2024, and you can watch the full video over on our YouTube channel. The theme for World Wildlife Day 2024 is exploring digital innovation and highlighting how digital conservation technologies can drive wildlife conservation. This World Wildlife Day, we are joined by Lydia Katsis, Senior Technical Specialist at the Zoological Society of London's Conservation and Technology Programme, and we're going to be exploring some of the diverse digital tools that enhance the conservation of global biodiversity. So welcome, Lydia. Happy World Wildlife Day.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy World Wildlife Day.
Thank you. So we are going to get stuck into it. So the initial question that I had was around the Internet of Things. So this is something that I think most technologies that are being developed for wildlife conservation are kind of being embedded into or are using. So can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, so Internet of Things is basically any sensors or systems which can be connected to other ones, usually via the internet or some form of other network, like a mobile network. And we're using them in all the, like, in every day really, including lots of household devices. Like, for instance, if you have a thermostat which can communicate with your mobile phone in order to set the temperature, that's one example. I wouldn't say it's really widely used right now in the conservation technology, but I think it's a direction that people are going into a lot. So for instance, you can get connected camera traps where the camera traps can send those images over a mobile network to the cloud, mm-hmm. and there you can extract the images yourself. And that can save you a lot of time and effort if those cameras are in really difficult to locate places. So it saves you the effort of kind of going to check on everyone, or it could also communicate information such as the battery level of that camera, because often a huge effort is taken into going into the field and changing the batteries and the camera traps. So that can be really useful.
So you talk about camera traps, and you've bought one here. So
yeah camera trap.
So can you explain a bit more about kind of the features and what it does?
Yeah, so camera traps are become like a mainstay of conservation, I'd say. Nearly everyone has used them or is using them at some point, and they've just been really quite revolutionary for efficiently monitoring mostly ground-dwelling mammals, but also a diversity of other things if you put them in the tree, for instance. So essentially how they work is you will get a number of them and you'll deploy them in a location, and then they have a heat sensor on them, typically, and so when an animal that's emitting heat walks by, it will trigger an image to be taken, and then you'll get several pictures of whatever has triggered it. And you can leave them in the forest for several months in a network, and so in that way you can capture really interesting information that you would never get if you just walked out into the forest. You would never encounter those cryptic or rare animals, just because what's the chance on a single walk you would see them, and especially if they're not wanting to be seen by humans, you just won't see them.
So they're capturing a lot of data then, I guess.
Yeah.
So they're triggered every time there's a motion, for example.
Yeah.
So is that something that then has to be manually processed?
Yeah, so that can be a bit of a limiting factor. So it is good that, so typically people have this triggering mechanism on them, so that stops them from, you know, taking 10 million images a day. But you could still, you might get a blade of grass in front of the sensor, and that could still trigger it 1,000 times. So often what people are really faced with is separating pictures with actual animals in them from pictures where they were just kind of falsely triggered by something that's essentially nothing.
Yeah.
So that can be quite time consuming. So often the first step is like basically filtering out thousands and thousands of non-animal pictures.
Yeah.
And that has typically been done manually. But in the recent years, there have been really impressive artificial intelligence methods that people have developed to automate this process, where basically people have trained machine learning models to identify which images have animals, which don't, and then kind of automatically filter them. And I think that's been a huge time saver for a lot of people, especially when you're deploying hundreds of cameras.
Yeah.
It quickly mounts up how long it takes to kind of go through them.
Yeah, I think in the past, some people had used citizen scientists to go through and look at them.
So, I mean, camera trap footage is really engaging. Everyone's excited to see it. The researchers are as well. Like, not everyone wants to use AI, because a lot of them are just excited to see the images.
And yeah.
It's the fruits of their labour and they want to see it. And it's also really engaging for citizen scientists. It's really fun and cool to go through pictures from monitoring in these amazing environments, yeah. or even in kind of environments close to home where you don't realise that there are these kind of cryptic animals around. So yeah, our team has a platform called Instant Wild, where images from camera traps are uploaded and citizen scientists can then go through and tag the pictures for the scientists to help them out.
So you've brought another sensor with you, and this is an audio moth. So can you talk to us a little bit about what an audio moth is?
Yeah, so as you can see, this is much smaller than the camera trap, is for comparison, so it's basically the size of like a matchbox. And these have been used, these have been developed more recently than the camera traps, and they're kind of currently starting to be adopted really widely. So these are small acoustic sensors, and they're also really low cost. And they work in kind of a similar way to the camera trap. So what we'd do is we would deploy them in an environment, and they would record sound, and then they'll save that to an SD card, and then we go and collect them and look at the data. And this can detect a huge variety of different types of sounds, so thinking birds, bats, also sounds made by humans, such as like from a gun or from a chainsaw, and several mammal species, things happening in the trees. So lots of things that the camera trap won't detect, these can detect. And they will also, so a camera trap will only really be taking an image of something that's like right within its viewpoint, which is quite a narrow area. Whereas depending on the sound, audio moths or just acoustic sensors can be detecting sound from really quite far away. So then you're kind of increasing your coverage when you're doing your survey. Mm. So for instance, elephants make really, really low frequency sounds, which travel incredibly far. So you can be picking those up from like maybe a kilometre or so away.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but unlike the camera traps, which have this triggering mechanism, often what we do with the acoustic sensors is that we continuously record the data. Mm-hmm. So we'll just set them up and say, okay, record, you know, for 2 hours every day between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. or depending on what your target is. And as you can imagine, that really, really quickly racks up a huge amount of data.
Yeah.
And it's much more difficult to kind of manually go through than the camera trap data, and a bit less probably satisfying than seeing nice images. So that's kind of been the limiting factor in using the acoustic methods. But as of recently, there have been some really, really powerful kind of new technology to analyze these data using artificial intelligence, which have really made it now possible to use these sensors on a wider scale, because people have trained different types of models which can kind of automatically process the data and say, okay, you have this bird species here, you have this bat species here, mm-hmm. and that really speeds up the process and allows you to actually kind of use them at scale and understand what's in the environment.
With both these sensors, when we're deploying them in hotspots for wildlife, do we have to have a lot of ethical considerations before doing so?
Yeah, so it's definitely something that we need to think about. So depending on where you're deploying them, there might be humans living in that area,
yeah.
and you really have to consider what impact it's going to have on them.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, it could be really a violation of their privacy if you're kind of capturing images of them, and also in some areas it's actually been used to threaten local communities.
Yeah.
So for instance, there's been a study in Asia where they found that the camera traps deployed around the forests of the local community were really kind of like threatening the people there, and they were changing their behaviour because they felt really uncomfortable about it. And also you have ethical concerns, you know, when you're capturing, as a researcher, when you're capturing images, identifiable images, say of poachers, what do you do with that? It's definitely something that's of concern and that we need to think about a lot more. And a big part of it is kind of engaging with the communities when you're, if you're putting out camera traps or technology in areas where they're living, to discuss it with them and kind of get their permission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's obviously always better to work with the communities anyway, because they'll probably know the best areas for putting camera traps to get certain images of wildlife. So how in the past, before we had network sensors, were wildlife monitored?
So, I mean, traditionally wildlife were monitored by just walking around in that area and like doing a transect, so walking along a line and recording everything you see.
Right.
And you can imagine that that's really, really time consuming. If you want to cover a huge area, you're having to have human teams to do all of that. And also you're really unlikely to see a lot of species. So sometimes you just see like a mark that the species was there.
Yeah.
So like, you know, a paw print or scat or something, or a nest.
Yeah.
So you're really getting a lot less information, and it takes a lot more time and it's a lot more effort. And so yeah, that was pretty much how people were doing surveys. So that's why these techniques have really revolutionized kind of the situation for conservation, because now you can put out many, many sensors. Now they're becoming increasingly low cost across an entire area potentially.
Yeah.
And simultaneously kind of monitor that area for months on end.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a huge wealth of information.
So you spoke a little bit earlier about artificial intelligence and using machine learning to process the kind of wealth of data that's coming out of this. What sort of way can this be used other than obviously just processing the amount of information? Can it be used to do, for example, like predictive mapping?
Yeah, so you can use these artificial intelligence models to do a huge variety of things. So often with our monitoring data, we're kind of doing things which are speeding up the process for us to then do our analyses. So that is often classification of your images or your sounds to then do something with it.
Yeah.
But there are other other ways that we can use these methods to our advantage. So for instance, people have been using AI to model where poachers are most likely to put snares in protected areas, because people have collected data about where they have found snares.
Yeah.
But obviously that doesn't include all of the areas. It's just where they happen to go to. So how do you work out, you know, where else snares might be likely to occur? So researchers from Harvard with SMART have been working out these really impressive AI models, which can be like predictively mapping where they might be most likely to find snares. And they actually found that those models really increased the amount of snares that the rangers were collecting on their patrols. So it was actually very effective.
So obviously we've spoken a lot about all of these benefits of the developing technology and what it can help bring to wildlife conservation. But an issue that's definitely getting raised for this year for World Wildlife Day is the fact that an estimated 3.7 billion people, or almost half of the world's population, currently do not have access to the internet, which creates this massive digital divide. And it's the least developed countries which are the least connected, and they are often the ones with the largest biodiversity. So this creates kind of a huge hurdle for leveraging new technologies which can be used for collective conservation and engaging people across the world in this type of conservation. So for us really to be able to protect species on the brink of extinction, there needs to be equal opportunities and access to this technology. And this is something that is a big point for World Wildlife Day this year, that we're working to ensure digital inclusion by 2030. So thank you so much, Lydia, for coming along and joining and giving us a talk and telling us more about the technologies that are involved. Happy World Wildlife Day.
You're most welcome. Happy World Wildlife Day.